18, 1999, Dr. George Lundberg, editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, published a study in which 60% of college students claimed that oral sex was not real sex. In July 1999, the Washington Post discovered an unsettling new fad. Suburban middle school kids were commonly giving each other oral sex at parks, houses, and schools. 20% of teens have had oral sex by age 15. A survey by Seventeen and the Kaiser Family Foundation revealed that 55% of teens had engaged in oral sex, as opposed to 40% engaging in vaginal intercourse. The Chicago Sun-Times termed oral sex the new third base, while quoting 16-year-old John, who goes to private high school and won't have real sex, but began having oral sex at age 14. It happens mostly at parties or after school, sometimes when the girls are a little bit drunk. And these days, even the grade sevens are doing it. People don't even think about it as bad anymore. It's cool if you do it, concurred 13-year-old Alyssa. As for the parents, they're most likely upstairs watching Sex in the City, at least according to an NBC People poll from 2004. Teens ages 13 to 16 were asked about places they received information about sex and sexual relationships. 70% of teens said they received either a lot or some information about sex from their parents. Yet 54% of the teens felt that a teenager who has oral sex is still a virgin. 57% felt it was okay for teens who are 17 or 18 to have oral sex, while only 15% of surveyed parents believed that their teens had gone beyond kissing. 27% of teens reported being with someone in an intimate or sexual way. Psychologist Dr. Wayne Warren told the New York Times, "I see girls 7th and 8th graders, even 6th graders, who tell me they're virgins and they're going to wait to have intercourse until they meet the man they'll marry. But then they've had oral sex 50 to 60 times. It's like a goodnight kiss to them, how they say goodbye after a date. Goodnight blowjobs? Clinton may like this world he helped build, but it's revolting for those of us with any moral standards at all. Here's the bottom line. Without the Lewinsky scandal, millions of children would not have had to hear about this issue until reaching maturity. Instead, oral sex and masturbation with cigars became topics of conversation in classrooms and around dinner tables throughout the country." Agonized mother of four, Elizabeth Avery Shelton, expressed it well in her letter to the editor of the Seattle Times. "I would like it to be known, before her movie and book deal comes out, that I want an apology from Lewinsky for being solely responsible for me having to explain oral sex to my four children, ages 12 to 8. Clinton and his media cronies owe parents an apology as well. Unfortunately, an apology just won't cut it at this point. The ship has left the dock." Parental abdication. Comprehensive sex education has taken power out of the hands of parents. The current system has the schools teaching amoral permissiveness and forcing parents with standards to unteach their own children. And parents have become too lazy to do anything about it. Instead of opting their kids out of sex ed, it's easier for them to avoid the messy birds and bees conversation. Leave it to the government employees to teach the kids about standards of morality. The social liberals who have promulgated this anti-parent system are pleased with the result. Their goal was never to allow parents the authority to teach their children. It was to shill for the god of tolerance. Government is the most easily available tool to use toward this end, and it is certainly the most powerful. As Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders put it, "We taught them what to do in the front seat of a car. Now it's time to teach them what to do in the back seat." The callousness here is unmistakable. If government usurpation of parental authority means sacrificing some kids to the consequences of emotionally barren sex, venereal disease, and abortion, so be it. The social liberals are creating a utopian, live-and-let-live society, and you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Social liberals can't get away with stating their goals out loud, so they hide behind the screen of youth autonomy. They're just giving kids respect, they say. They're just providing full information. It is this perverse view of child autonomy that has led to widespread abortion rights for children. The kids were old enough and smart enough to have sex, and now they're old enough and smart enough to get an abortion without parental notification. Democratic Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois explains this view. Officials at the state and federal levels are trying to take away young people's rights to reproductive health services, including access to contraceptives, family planning, and abortion. This grants children just enough rope to hang themselves and their fetuses. Autonomy in the form of a suicide pill. The combination of parental abdication and social liberalism in our schools means that kids are easy targets for nihilism and moral subjectivism. Ironically, by destroying parental authority with regard to morality, social liberals got more than they bargained for. Rampant drug, alcohol, and tobacco use. Almost three-quarters of suburban 12th graders and 71% of urban 12th graders have tried alcohol more than two or three times. 40% of 12th graders in both urban and suburban schools have used illegal drugs. More than 60% of suburban 12th graders have tried cigarettes, as have 54% of urban 12th graders. We're now at the crisis point, and parents are beginning to wake up. A poll released in February 2003 by Zogby International showed strong support for abstinence education and a remarkable antipathy toward the liberal social messages taught in comprehensive sex ed. For example, 71% of parents disapproved of teaching a middle school child, ages 12 to 15, to unroll a condom and place it on a finger, banana, or wooden model of a penis. Another 71% disapproved of telling children, ages 9 to 12, that homosexual love relationships can be as satisfying as heterosexual love relationships. A plurality, 46% to 39%, disapproved of telling 14 to 18-year-olds that teenagers can obtain birth control pills from family planning clinics and doctors without permission from a parent. And 70% disapproved of schools handing out contraception without their permission. A full 69% of parents believed that 9 to 12-year-olds should be taught sexual or physical intimacy should occur between two people involved in a lifelong, mutually faithful marriage commitment. And 74% believed that 15 to 18-year-olds should be taught that they need not worry about pregnancy or STDs if they are abstinent. These parents have a reason to be angry. They've been cut out of the loop. And these explicit and ill-thought public school courses have become the primary source for their children's views about sex. After feeling the consequences of social liberalism, parents are waking up. To preserve the innocence of their children and equip them with a moral worldview, it's up to these parents to stand up for their kids, accept their responsibilities, and start acting like, well, parents. Chapter 3. Campus Carnality. Let's not burn the universities yet. After all, the damage they do might be worse. H.L. Mencken. College life for the porn generation is the social liberals' dream. In an environment dominated by secular humanism and political correctness, no one ever makes judgments about sexual activity. And the dirty little secret of the matter is, that's the way the universities want it. Today, it's the universities promoting co-ed dorms, tolerant speech codes, and sexual experimentation. It's the tenured hippies and their capitulating compatriots from the 1960s running the universities now. The ones who used to want a revolution are now the institution. When they first enter college, students are thrust into an uncertain world, usually without friends or family to guide them. So they seek guidance from administrators, professors, and peer, each source worse than the last. With parents out of the picture, the university's objections to traditional morality create a values vacuum for students. In the context of that vacuum, the tolerant, live-and-let-live attitude of the institutional leaders filters down to the students. The common feeling is, as Elliot Davis, Cornell University class of 2004, expresses it, people do what they want to do. It doesn't bother me. And so students feel free to do what they want to do, knowing that there's no danger of stigma or condemnation. Janie, a 22-year-old UCLA student, embodies these notions. I do whatever I want, and I've never thought twice about it, Janie told me. Janie has sex. If I've been dating a guy for a while and we say we love each other, couldn't a guy just lie? I've had guys say they loved me before, but I know they don't mean it. It's intuition. According to Janie, she's not a slut. I've been having sex since I was 15, right? and I'm 21 now, so that's 6 years, and yet I've only had 5 partners. You know, that's pretty good compared to other people who started having sex when they were 15. With values like these, and the prevailing societal attitude of tolerance for such values, is it any wonder that 49% of women aged 18 to 19 had sex with at least 2 partners in the year 2002? And 81% of women aged 20 to 24 in 2002 had become sexually active before age 20. Not only do colleges induct students into the fancy free world of if it feels good, do it, they subvert all opposing authorities, particularly parents. Parents drop their kids off, telling them to find themselves. When the kids return, they haven't found themselves. They've found a substitute for the familial safety net in professors, peers, and random sex. Everyone needs a philosophical framework to justify their existence, and if parents won't provide it, the universities certainly will. And so they fill the values vacuum with a moral framework based on narcissism and hedonism. As columnist Suzanne Fields writes, "Where morality is dumbed down, it takes nerve to protest the tyranny of the student bodies." Sex over poker. It's Wednesday night, and a group of friends and classmates from Harvard Law are gathered around a poker table. We're in one of the dorm complexes. I'm down about $10, and everyone has had a beer or two. We've been playing for about an hour, and the conversation has revolved completely around 2 topics, rock music and sex. In between discussion of the best cover song ever for a rock album, AJ tells the group that he's found a sex partner online. "She's into spanking, and I figured that sounds like it's worth a try," he says. "Dude, that's a good way to get yourself beaten up by 8 guys meeting a girl for sex online," Jimmy answers. "I heard a story from one of my friends about a guy he knew who liked to get rough with his girlfriend," volunteers Jason. "So one time they were having sex, and he just pulled out and punched her right in the crotch." Others groan. Jimmy offers, "One time, a guy I knew, his girlfriend kept asking him to hurt her over and over, so he just grabbed a toaster and smacked her in the head with it." "So AJ," Jason asks, "did you end up going out with your best friend's friend?" "Yeah," AJ answers, "but it wasn't really a date." "Did you try to get some from her?" "Nah." "Good move." The conversation continues like this for hours. Sex, class, rock music. Sex, rock music, sex. Sex, sex, sex. An hour before the game, I had attended a reception for Harvard Law 1Ls, first years, held by a major New York law firm. I was standing around with a few of the fellows from the class. "So, did you hear about what happened to Adam?" Jimmy asked me. "No," I said. "Well," Jimmy explains, "Adam was in Costa Rica with a bunch of other people from our class, and they went to a bar. Some random girl approached him, and he went in the bathroom with her. She gave him a blowjob in a stall." I make a disapproving face. "Ben, that isn't the bad part," Jimmy says. "Oh." "So later," Jimmy continues, "the group sees this girl being tossed out of the bar. So they ask the bartender what's going on." "Oh, that's some guy who goes around giving people blowjobs and we have to toss him every night," the bartender tells them. Turns out that the girl was a transvestite. Ugh. It's probably not the best idea in the world to go around taking oral sex from random people anyway, if only for STD reasons, I state. Another guy, Alan, chimes in. "Well, I'll tell you, I'm usually good about making sure the girl doesn't have anything," he says. "But when a girl starts to go down on me, I'm not going to stop her." It's worth noting that few of the people I talked to that night could be described as politically liberal. Jason is a libertarian, Jimmy is a Midwestern guy with a conservative streak on crime and economics, and a slightly conservative tinge on social issues. Still, none of these escapades triggered any moral consternation. None of these people could be described as stupid or ignorant either. Each is a student at the top law school in the country. Yet free sex, sex that ignores both possible consequences and emotional involvement, is commonplace. And it's not just at Harvard. This girl who's a freshman at my school, she said she had sex with 5 guys in 1 week, 2004 American University graduate Marty Beckerman told me. That's an extreme example, but that kind of anonymous, quick, totally emotionless stuff, I don't know how many times in college I heard somebody say they had no idea the name of the guy or girl they had sex with last night. Beckerman tells another story emphasizing his point. I had this friend who was a 17-year-old junior in high school, and he was hanging out with us, and he was like, I have to go to your college. I really want to have sex with a college girl. I wasn't really hot on the idea, but he was insistent.
So he comes to the campus, and we're hanging out, and it's late, and we're in a friend's room, and a girl comes in who's effing trashed.
Really, really drunk. So we're like, Ashley, this is our friend. He's a junior, too. Of course, he was a junior in high school, and she was a junior in college, but she didn't know that. And she's like, oh. Within 2 minutes of introducing these two to each other, they were in her room having oral sex. Check your morals at the dorm. Consider a world made up entirely of 18-year-old men and women, hormones raging, walk around in towels and pajamas like sisters and brothers, often sharing bathrooms and sometimes bedrooms, and much of the time, beds. Welcome to dorm life for the porn generation. The social situation makes for its own unique and bizarre rules and practices. Roommates are sexiled when their roommates are getting busy in the dorm room. Lucia, a 23-year-old 2004 alum of New York University, explains the basic principle of sexiling. I suppose at its most impolite, it is when the roommate returns home, usually late at night, and has been locked out of his/her room, whether physically by a door lock or emotionally by the potential visual of what's going on inside, because their roommate is hooking up with someone. It often happens as a stated agreement between roommates too, though. I was more than happy to vacate the room so my roommate could have it on Valentine's Day with her boyfriend. Typically, people from the same dorm don't hook up or date. That's known as dormcest. According to Lucia, dormcest often leads to sweatpant romance, which is kind of a funny concept. It's not really dating because you don't get dressed and go out of the building. You just stop by in your sweatpants and get laid or whatever. Kind of the lazy man's dating. I had a friend who called off a hooking up relationship purely out of her distaste for the label of sweatpant romance. The average college student is getting plenty of action. An independent women's forum study found that 40% of college women had hooked up, and 10% had hooked up more than 6 times. Hooking up, for the non-porn generation readers, is any sexual contact, ranging from kissing to sexual intercourse, in which the participants expected no further contact. Elizabeth Marquardt, who led the research team, stated that in the study, co-ed dorms kept coming up in a negative way. They have reduced the mystery of male-female relationships, while facilitating joined-at-the-hip relationships. Wendy Shallett, author of A Return to Modesty, Discovering the Lost Virtue, accurately describes the situation. When the dorms are co-ed, and even the bathrooms are co-ed, and we're all thrown together, there's no escape from the culture of immodesty. When everything is integrated, there's no mystery, and there's no separation. And there's no reverence between the sexes. Rick Gabrielle, a student at Haverford College in Pennsylvania, unwittingly seconds the motion. Co-ed is great. You get used to being around the opposite sex. I walk into the bathroom and there'll be a girl brushing her teeth, and then I'll jump in the shower. Talk about the death of romance. With sex readily available at every turn, it's no wonder only 38% of college guys are in a serious relationship. Dates and, for the most part, love affairs are passé, writes 2001 Princeton grad Laura Vanderkam. Why bother asking someone to dinner when you can meet at a party, down a few drinks, and go home together? Princeton class of 04 Justin Johnson sums it up. No one dates. It's not as though college administrators didn't realize that the natural result of close proximity between hormonal teenagers would lead to sex. In fact, many dorms have taken precautions to provide the students with easy access to contraceptives. At Oberlin College in Ohio, dorm bulletins announced the popular weekly safe sex night at the dance hall. Doug, a recent NYU grad, told me either the RAs, residence assistants, or health services would hand out condoms, a situation that is common to many universities. UCLA's Dykstra Hall was one of the nation's first co-ed dorms, established in 1960. As early as 1994, the administration set up a dispensing machine for condoms.
Nora Zamichow of the Los Angeles Times pronounces that the degree of casual contact between the sexes at Dykstra is stunning.
It's not too easy to stun an LA Times reporter. Marisa, a 22-year-old UCLA senior, lived in one of the nicer dorms on campus with three roommates. She says that contraception was definitely available, and specifically cites a big fair at the beginning of the year in the dorms. It is mainly for freshmen to get acquainted with college and dorm life. I go every year. The Student Health Advocate, SHA, table was handing out colored condoms. The SHAs, by the way, have office hours in UCLA's dorms, during which they hand out free over-the-counter contraceptives. Think of it as improving convenience in an on-demand world. Marisa also recalls a time when one of her roommates allowed her boyfriend to move into their room. He even brought his stuff, like clothes and things, she remembers. He slept with her in the same bed, with three other girls in the same room. Those who protest dorm policies that encourage this zoo-like environment are ostracized and ridiculed. In 1998, five Orthodox Jewish students sued Yale University, asking that they be allowed to live off-campus. They objected to the sexual atmosphere of the dorms. In particular, they weren't happy with co-ed toilets and showers, sex manuals, and condom availability, and required safe sex lectures for freshmen. Instead of accommodating their request, the Yale administration ripped into the students, stating that dorm life was a central part of Yale's education. Richard Levin, the president of the Yale Hillel, a campus Jewish organization, stated that if the students weren't willing to live in the dorms, they shouldn't have come to Yale in the first place. Why come to a university like this one if you won't open your mind to new ideas and new perspectives? He queried. This is not a place where people who close themselves off to the world can thrive. In the end, the students paid for campus housing and then lived off campus. In recent years, new and more disturbing arrangements have been developing. Many campuses have created co-ed dorm rooms where students of opposite sexes share actual living space. Haverford College in Pennsylvania has employed such a strategy. Their aim is to replicate a family situation where students share a home with separate bedrooms. Though administrators concede that boyfriends-girlfriends have taken advantage of the situation. NYU also offers co-ed space. I think it's a valid option that should be open to consenting students, says Lucia. I don't think it represents an over-sexualization at all. It's just universities needing to keep up with the pace of social culture. This is the familiar market argument. Society is leading universities, not the other way around. There's a market for sexual freedom, so why not let the universities cater to it? Such an argument ignores all pretense of social responsibility. If society is moving in a more and more perverse direction, is it not the job of the universities to remain a shining beacon of truth? After all, that's what the universities proclaim themselves to be. UCLA's motto is Fiat Lux, or Let There Be Light. NYU's is Prestare et Prestare, to persevere and to excel. Harvard, Veritas, truth. And yet, these same universities run from the idea of objective truth in pursuit of feel-good, live-and-let-live morality. It is strange that in their flight from the very notion of objective truth, the universities have anointed their own version of tolerant truth as sacrosanct. Hence the current renaissance of speech codes designed to restrict any mode of thought other than the one promulgated by the universities. Columnist David Limbaugh reported in 2003, some have estimated that as many as 90% of American universities have adopted such codes in one form or another. Most speech codes are vague enough to sound plausibly open-minded. Still, it's hard to imagine that the tolerance espoused by the universities invariably extends to those with traditional moral views. University of Colorado at Boulder expects students to join together to ensure a climate of diversity, where everyone values individual and group differences, respects the perspectives of others, and communicates openly to attain the best education. At Harvard Law, students are informed that they are joining a community ideally characterized by free expression, free inquiry, intellectual honesty, respect for the dignity of others, and openness to constructive change. The rights and responsibilities exercised within the community must be compatible with these qualities. Standards don't come much vaguer than this. It's not difficult to see how quoting Leviticus or St. Paul could inhibit the dignity of others, especially in an environment where the law school dean condemns military recruitment on campus due to their unjust policy of don't ask, don't tell. Other universities are clearer about their goals. University of California at Berkeley opposes speech that contains harassment, intimidation, exploitation, and other forms of discrimination that are based on race, ethnicity, sex, religion, sexual orientation, disability, and other personal characteristics.
Kansas State University avers, every person, regardless of race, color, creed, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, age, or disability, shall be treated with respect and dignity.
The universities have instituted a new right, the right not to be offended. When tolerance of every sort of behavior reigns, those who believe in standards and rules are destined for castigation. Professors as parents. Universities embody another characteristic that social liberals love: replacement of parents as authority figures. And these new, improved parents aren't likely to give you rules to follow or goals to reach. They'll sanction whatever you decide to do. In fact, they go further than sanctioning licentious behavior. They actively proselytize for it. College, for the porn generation, is a whole new, fresh, exciting world. A world without rules. Since the 1960s, the inmates have been running the asylums. When students protested administrative power during that tumultuous period, administrators and professors caved in some cases even cheering on the rowdy young idiots. Robert Bork, who was a professor of law at Yale during this time, recalls, "That was the pattern across the United States in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Violent rhetoric and violent action from the fascists of the New Left, followed by the abject moral surrender of academic officials the public had a right to expect would defend the universities and the orderly processes of their governance. Many of the student radicals of the 1960s are now the professors and administrators at universities. Their views have not moderated. Just as Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, proclaimed in their 1962 Port Huron statement, the current goal of the professoriate is finding a meaning in life that is personally authentic. As Bork comments, this translated as foul language, sexual promiscuity, marijuana and hard drugs, and disdain for the military and for conventional success. In many ways, nothing has changed. Professors are still rebelling against traditional morality. Only this time, they're leading young people down the path to acceptance of deviancy and rejection of faith and family. Sexual experimentation is taught and encouraged. According to Princeton University sociology professor Patricia Fernandez Kelly, those who are in serious relationships in college are missing out. She says that it is important for people to protect themselves physically and emotionally, but disagrees with moralists who condemn sexual experimentation. I don't think we can come out and discourage sexual experimentation, agrees Elizabeth Paul, an associate professor of psychology at New Jersey College. As soon as students arrive on campus, they're introduced to the world of sexual self-awareness by the administration. I remember very distinctly there was a sex orientation during the orientation over the summer, before entering freshman year, says a recent NYU grad, Doug. They had a professional sex therapist or something come demonstrate everything from condoms to dental dams. Lucia remembers the situation as well. I remember the whole orientation being pretty sexually charged in general, but one of the workshops towards sexual education, and knowing the resources the university makes available, resources like free condoms and dental dams, counseling, crisis resources, pamphlets. At orientation specifically, we played games, watched demonstrations, and the workshop itself was conducted by the head of the sexual health center. All that in a box of press-on nails. At UC Berkeley, one class involved male and female students discussing their sexual fantasies, porn star lecturers, strip club field trips with instructor sexual demonstrations, and class exercises in which students photographed their own genitalia. This class was keeping with the students as teachers theme of the 1960s radicals. As columnist John Leo wrote, a lot of educational theory says that teacher-led classes are too hierarchical. They imply that teachers know more than students. In student-led classes, there aren't any teachers, just coordinators and facilitators, and everybody is on the same level. Everyone in the class received 2 credits. Courses on porn have become commonplace around the country. Universities that have offered such courses include Kansas University, San Francisco State University, University of Massachusetts Amherst, Chapman University, Northwestern University, and University of California, Santa Cruz. At Wesleyan University, they describe a porn course almost as a social good. The pornography we study is an art of transgression, which impels human sexuality toward, against, and beyond the limits which have traditionally defined civil discourses and practices. Our examination accordingly includes the implication of pornography in so-called perverse practices, such as voyeurism, bestiality, sadism, and masochism. The list goes on. Other universities use their sex courses as a formula for postmodern radicalism. Women's studies and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, LGBT, studies departments, specifically designed to fight social traditionalism, dominate the universities. Yale has a Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program, in which gender, the social meaning of the distinction between the sexes, and sexuality, sexual identities, discourses, and institutions, are studied as they intersect with class, race, ethnicity, nationality, and transnational movements. And Harvard pumps as much radical social liberalism as it can into its women, gender, and sexuality department. Cultural and historical differences in femininities and masculinities, transnational sexualities, women writers, gender and media studies, lesbian, gay, bisexual studies, transnational feminisms, gender and environmental movements, philosophies of embodiment, queer theory, women's history, transgender studies, gender and religion, the political economy of gender, feminist theory, race, class, gender politics, technology and gender and science, and masculinity studies are just a few of the areas of study that fall within this concentration's purview. Their website excitedly explains. With this department description, Harvard actually surpasses James Joyce in the Guinness Book of World Records for the largest amount of intellectual drivel ever crammed into one sentence. On many campuses, rabidly leftist departments like sociology and English work in concert with the LGBT and women's studies departments in order to push sexual license. At UCLA, the English department cross-lists courses with the LGBT department and women's studies department. Such courses include M101A, Intro to LGBT Studies, described by the campus gay magazine as follows. To a closeted gay boy, soon to shed the cocoon and emerge a winged Nubian princess, this class was all that in a box of press-on nails. The two professors were the perfect yin-yang combination. Professor Schultz's bright fairy flame lit the fires of pride in my soul, and Professor Littleton's uber-dykiness slapped me with reason and political reality. Apparently, singing YMCA in class will now move you one step closer to a university degree. A strange new world. Surrounded by sex in the context of dorm life, campus life, and classroom life, getting sucked into the oversexed culture of the universities is easy, and it's dangerous. Still, Lucia, who lost her virginity at age 21 and has had 2 sex partners since, believes that it's good for both college guys and college girls to get their grooves on. Sexual experiences and sex in general are great things, especially when you are young. I wish I had hooked up more. As long as a student is safe and is generally cognizant of how his/her actions may affect the people involved, I think it's a necessary thing to go through in life, she said. But that's just the problem. Youngsters engaging in sexual experimentation don't know what they're getting into. For young women, pressure to fit in often means sacrificing emotional well-being. Where once there were sanctioned excuses for upholding traditional morality, it's against university policy, men aren't allowed in the dorms, etc., the porn generation now finds only encouragement to discard traditional morality at every opportunity. The long-term side effects are even more disturbing. In a world of one-night stands and random hookups, it's only natural for young men to view women as sex objects. For young men, college is a cornucopia of illicit pleasures. Playing the field is the norm at college, Mikkel Moore, a 22-year-old student at Southern Illinois University, explained to the Los Angeles Times. Everyone is looking for people to hook up with at parties, and both people are content with that. A university is like a community of kids, so open, and we are free to really do what we want. I know when I got here, I thought, ooh, give me all the college girls. Lucia sees what men want as well. I think the real difference between men and women lies in the fact that women think about these issues at all, and most men probably don't. College boys are more apt to act and only think about it if it gets them into trouble later on. It's notable that despite Lucia's awareness about college boys, she's still upset she didn't hook up with more of them. Sex is considered a substitute for developing an actual relationship. For guys especially, if you're able to have sex with a good-looking girl on a regular basis, that's an excellent incentive to keep a bad, pointless, or even self-destructive relationship going. And if you're able to get several random, good-looking girls to give you sex, why bother attempting relationships at all? With the death of emotional and intellectual relationships, young people are trying to find themselves and their partners solely through physicality. Even Lucia recognizes the danger in this trend. What I fear most is seeing young people try to figure out or articulate their emotions through sex and hooking up. I think some have the mentality of, oh well, I cheated on him and I don't feel bad, so I should break up with him. Or, oh, I cheated and I feel horrible, so this must mean I love him and should stay with him. You know, using others as a means to figure your own emotional relationship junk out. The saddest part of the sexual experimentation promoted by the higher education system and by the parents who willingly and inexcusably offer their children into its clutches is that all of these detrimental consequences are avoidable. Yet those parents and administrators who approved of the actions during the 1960s are actively seeking to pass the torch across generations. While others choose to ignore the negative consequences of their former activities, thereby allowing their children to go through an even worse chaos. Either way, this is nothing less than spiritual and emotional child sacrifice, with countless and very real Charlotte Simmons clones emerging at the end.
If you give people more freedom, ultimately they become more responsible, says Sarah Jamieson, a 2000 grad of Connecticut College.
That's the hope. College is supposed to be a time when young adults discover who they want to be. Self-discovery implies unrestrained freedom, trying new things, all with the hope that the identity you discover is something to aspire to, equipping you to find success and lead in the real world. But the former hippies of the 1960s have charted a different path as university leaders, and they've found the porn generation all too eager to follow, delving into sexual experimentation, nihilism, narcissism, and hedonism. Forget fiat lux, prestare et prestare, or veritas. The motto of today's university is simple. Do whatever or whomever you want. Chapter 4. Pop-Tarts. Official recipe for pop stardom. Start with a cute, pubescent, 10 to 12-year-old girl. 2-3 years. Virginal, wholesome, faux innocent play acting. Disney Channel brand highly recommended. 2 years. Ambiguous, semi-pedophilic cavorting. 2 years. Sexual discovery. Dirty dancing, X-rated lyrics, and or promiscuity. For extra sales, add just a smattering of bisexuality. Voila! You've transformed yourself into a platinum record artist. Keep it up for 20 years, and you might even win a Madonna Award for profit-driven sluttiness. It was the passing of the torch. On August 28, 2003, MTV held its annual Video Music Awards show. The big production number was like something out of the Gay Activist Handbook. First, two little girls, Madonna's six-year-old daughter Lourdes and one of Lourdes' friends, romped across the stage dressed as flower girls. Then, the competing princesses of Pop-Tart whoredom, Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, both dressed in sluttish bridal costumes, popped out of wedding cakes and began singing Madonna's 1984 hit Like a Virgin. Finally, Madonna made her grand entrance. Dressed in a black, form-fitting S&M groom outfit, Madonna joined the two former Mouseketeers, and the three gyrated around the stage like hookers starved for Johns. Shifting into her newest hit song, Hollywood, Madonna began feeling up Spears and Aguilera on stage. In one especially repulsive move, Madonna snuggled up to Aguilera's thigh and removed her garter. Then the choreographed moment everyone had been waiting for. Madonna lunged in at the receptive Spears, who opened her mouth, and the two played a round of tonsil hockey. The crowd went wild as the on-the-spot camera panned to the stunned face of former Britney boy toy Justin Timberlake. When Madonna turned to Aguilera and proceeded to swap spit with the dirty young star, it was almost anticlimactic. The salacious kiss made front-page headlines across the United States and across the world. It made the top page of USA Today. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution even apologized to its subscribers after it received a wave of complaints from angry readers stunned to see the saliva exchange on page one. But the publicity ride wasn't done yet for the three prostitutes. Madonna called the kisses ironic because I was playing the groom and I had two brides, so we were operating at many levels. It was like a passing on of the baton, so to speak. For Madonna, more than one level of meaning constitutes uncharted intellectual depths. Combining the titillating and the political is quite a feat. Here's the real irony of the situation, however. While Madonna showed millions of little girls how to smooch other girls, she shielded her own daughter, Lourdes, from the actual kisses, explaining, "As soon as she got off stage, she was whisked away in a car and went home, so she doesn't know anything." The MTV Awards show was a monster hit, garnering 10.7 million viewers, and the highest ratings from the 12 to 34 crowd of any cable show that year to date. Predictably, stories concerning lesbian experimentation among teenage girls and articles about bisexual chic began appearing in the mainstream media. A December 2003 article in the South Florida Sun Sentinel described the growing demand for lesbian experimentation used by some as a turn-on to get guys, by others as a journey in self-discovery. Richard Luscombe of the UK Observer noted, "A wave of bisexual chic is sweeping the United States. Emboldened by such images as Madonna kissing Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera on a TV awards show, girls are proudly declaring their alternative sexuality at a younger age than ever before." As reported in January 2004 in the Washington Post, a Coolidge High School teacher got so fed up with girls nuzzling each other in class and other public places that he threatened to send any he saw to the principal's office. One high school girl interviewed, Shonda Harris, explained that she started going out with girls at age 14, following a breakup with her boyfriend. "Her mother," she says, "prefers me to be with girls than guys. She says I'm happier." What kind of boys was young Shonda dating? The illegitimate children of Charles Manson? Better question, why is she dating at all? The Post piece noted that teenagers are starting at younger ages to have same-sex sexual experiences. 13 for boys, 15 for girls. As the Post reporter triumphantly exclaimed, "Try this on, Mr. and Mrs. America. These girls say they don't know what they are and don't need to know. Adolescence and young adulthood is a time for exploration, and they should feel free to love a same-sex partner without assuming that is how they'll spend the rest of their lives." Here's the question. If one prominent lesbian snogfest, particularly an event choreographed and planned as a publicity stunt, can set off so much bisexual activity among young girls, what effect does constant promotion of promiscuity have on them? While the world expected Madonna to do her thing, and anything, on TV, Many people were shocked at the behavior of the two younger icons. After all, both Aguilera and Spears had been All-American girls next door during their days with the Mickey Mouse Club. But that's the new strategy in the pop music industry. The MTV Video Music Awards Kiss merely exposed for the world what the porn generation already knew. The teen pop industry is geared and focused on sexualizing girls at the earliest possible age. Forget singing, songwriting, or even basic musical talent. Sex is now the driving force in pop music. Hot young stars often begin as virgins to solidify their teen girl base, then move on to semi-sexuality, emerge into flagrant sexuality or even promiscuity, and for that extra edgy hipness, add a tang of bisexuality. The pop tarts start with sugary descriptions of love and teen angst. Then they turn dark, narcissistic, and hedonistic, and little girls go along for the ride. The Material Girl. Madonna was really the first pop artist to openly advocate amorality and subjectivism to young girls. She is a heroine to the social left and to feminists in particular. And that's no exaggeration. As New York Daily News writer Jim Farber wrote in 1991, "Sometimes I wake up in the morning and just think about how lucky we are all to live in the same world as Madonna. I am not being at all ironic." In August 1994, even with her musical career on the rocks, Norman Mailer called Madonna our greatest living female artist. Madonna was controversial because, in the words of Rolling Stone writer Mem Udovich, the singer was not only unapologetically sexual, but frankly horny. Where Donna Summer might talk about bad girls and loving to love you, Madonna made it clear that she was more than talk, beyond bad, and primarily interested in you loving her, whether you liked it or not. She has sex for her own pleasure, uses sex to her advantage, and challenges traditional morality. Instead of challenging sexist notions of morality by calling upon men to act like gentlemen, Madonna crawled into the muck with them and encouraged a generation of women to follow her, molding teenage girls into her image. The choice of Madonna's Hollywood for the MTV lesbian tonguing couldn't have been more appropriate. Here's the song's key lyric. "I'm bored with the concept of right and wrong." That lyric seems to be Madonna's credo. Her purposeful degradation of morality has led to monumental success for her and created a monumentally bad influence for her teenage fans. It was her appearance on the first MTV Video Music Awards, September 14, 1984, that made Madonna a household name. Dressed in a white bustier, identical to those worn by Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera 20 years later, and a belt reading "Boy Toy," identical to that worn by her daughter Lourdes 20 years later, Madonna burst from a wedding cake to sing "Like a Virgin." Like a virgin, touched for the very first time. Madonna warbled as she writhed around the stage, simulating sex. The message, according to biographer Andrew Morton, was that the notion of a virgin whore incongruity was old-fashioned, that it was okay to show off your body as well as your brain. Here was a woman who dressed wantonly and behaved badly, yet who, far from being punished for this behavior, was instead richly rewarded. Madonna's Like a Virgin album was astonishingly successful. The singer had expected the resulting firestorm and was prepared to take advantage of it. Madonna had opened up the first chapter in the Virgin Whore Pop-Tart Encyclopedia. While Madonna never claimed to be virginal, she used the imagery of virginity to contrast with her open sexuality. That's what her performance at the MTV Awards was all about, exploiting the trappings of moral absolutism to promote the ends of moral relativism. Madonna has always used the imagery of rectitude to promote degradation. Simply note the Catholic, and later faux Kabbalistic, imagery she constantly uses in her performances. Madonna's universe is a chaotic, existential place, but there, she is the ultimate arbiter of morality. It is that type of live-and-let-live universe in which each man-woman is his-her own god, which Madonna promotes. Millions of young girls picked up on it. As a hot young star in the 1980s, Madonna's wardrobe, a mix-and-match garage sale outfit topped off with a large cross necklace, became her trademark. This juxtaposition of religious symbols with the attire of homelessness smacks of amorality and chaos. And it was fantastically popular. As CNN.com describes, a fashion craze developed among teenage Madonna fans who imitated their new idol by dressing in torn-up clothes and rubber bracelets and tying rags in their hair. The Madonna look sparked a trend of young, wannabe fans. Madonna spawned a new generation of low-rent child prostitute posers a la Jodie Foster. In January 1985, Madonna filmed the music video for Material Girl, again glorifying her own sexual image. Material Girl clearly epitomizes Madonna's view of sex as well. It's simply a conduit to something more important. Money. Some boys kiss me, some boys hug me. I think they're okay. If they don't give me proper credit, I just walk away. 'Cause the boy with the cold hard cash is always Mr. Right. 'Cause we are living in a material world. And I am a material girl. Before Madonna, material girls were known as prostitutes. Afterward, they were just known as teenagers. In May 1985, Madonna's face appeared on the cover of Time magazine with the headline, Madonna, Why She's Hot. The piece describes how hundreds of thousands of young blossoms, whose actual ages run from a low of about 8 to a high of perhaps 25, are saving up their babysitting money to buy cross-shaped earrings and fluorescent rubber bracelets like Madonna's, white lace tights that they will cut off at the ankles, and black tube skirts that, out of view of their parents, they will roll down several turns at the waist to expose their middles and the waistbands of their pantyhose. The article concludes, then, the wannabes, to whom the war between men and women is still far less real than the eternal skirmishing between parents and children, file out of the hall, dreaming of the time when they will be able to do anything in the world they want, like Madonna. Madonna's career has been repetition of the same theme ever since. She should have been arrested in the late 1980s and 1990s for peddling pornography to children. The music video for Like a Prayer was so openly offensive that Pepsi was forced to cancel its endorsement deal with Madonna in 1989. Her 1990 music video for Justify My Love was so over the top that the liberal MTV banned it. In her Blonde Ambition tour, Madonna posed as a modern-day Amazon, her erotic and exotic routines invariably ending with the woman on top. The tour featured scantily clad men engaging in homoerotic behavior, Madonna miming masturbation, men in Viking-style pointed bras, and Madonna, the dominatrix, telling the crowd, "You may not know the song, but you all know the pleasures of a good spanking." She also published the photo album Sex, a porn book including shots of rape, homosexuality, and naked hitchhiking, as well as shots with her and other celebrities. The book currently adorns the coffee tables of hundreds of gay men and sperm banks. Madonna is a fabulously successful musician, a failed actress, and a cultural icon. She is also a whore, selling her promiscuity for power and financial gain. Like her Pop-Tart followers, Madonna's promiscuity has always been for a purpose. As one fellow dancer stated, "You could say she was a tramp, but that was missing the point. She was never some diggy white chick who slept around with the guys. She was smarter than that." All the way through her career, she has been very sexy, but take a closer look and she is always in control. She isn't just any whore either. She is a whore with a microphone, and she's always willing to use that microphone to forward her message of societal amorality. Princesses of the Virgin to Whore Kingdom. If Madonna is the queen of pop whoredom, the two reigning princesses are Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, whose careers have taken remarkably similar paths. Both Spears and Aguilera joined the cast of the Mickey Mouse Club. Both cut hit albums, ditched their virginal clean-cut images, and ended up exploiting their sexuality for publicity and monetary gain. And both took millions of young girls along for the ride, inducting them into a world of amorality and softcore pornography. Let's start with Christina. When celebrity first touched Aguilera, she posed as a clean-cut girl with a lot of talent. In 1999, she told Vibe magazine, It's important to me to be a positive role model. Parading around in my bra and a pair of hot pants will not inspire confidence in other girls. I'm not just another bimbo. I've got a brain and a heart, and I'm not going to let my body distract people from that fact. This moral stance lasted a couple of days. When her eponymous album broke in 1999 with the hit single Genie in a Bottle, many, including Disney Radio, were concerned about the song's overt sexuality. The lyrics to the song: I feel like I've been locked up tight for a century of lonely nights, waiting for someone to release me. If you want to be with me, I can make your wish come true. You gotta make a big impression. I gotta like what you do. I'm a genie in a bottle, baby. You gotta rub me the right way, honey. I'm a genie in a bottle, baby. Come, come, come on and let me out. The music video depicted a scantily clad Aguilera lying on a car hood, asking a male model to let her out. Aguilera defended the song, telling CNN Online, "The song is not about sex, it's about self-respect. It's about not giving in to temptation unless you are respected." Right. And men read Playboy for the articles. Christina learned her lesson well from Madonna, deriding opponents of the song as opponents of female rights. It's really about female empowerment. When a female speaks her mind and shows a little tummy like I do, people take it a certain way. I'm a huge fan of NSYNC, but when they're on stage doing pelvic thrusts and singing certain songs, nobody says anything negative about that. Aguilera's words are a perfect illustration of feminism's flawed logic. She rightly points out that boy bands are held to lesser standards than our female pop stars, but refuses to take the high road and dives in the ditch along with them. Aguilera told an interviewer at the time, "All this do not touch nonsense is not me. I'm no virgin. I'm all for female sexuality and taking the sexual power away from the guys. They've had it for way too long. Hey, if the boys can do it, why shouldn't Christina?" Aguilera initially attempted to downplay the sexuality creeping into her music in order to maintain her virginal image.
But in 2001, Aguilera teamed up with Pink, Lil' Kim, and Maya to remix the Patti LaBelle song Lady Marmalade for the ridiculously stupid motion picture Moulin Rouge. The music video depicts all four gallivanting around dressed like prostitutes.
It won an award at the MTV Video Music Awards in 2001, where the four singers reenacted the music video, which has nothing going for it besides skin and lacy underthings. In 2002, Aguilera took her sexuality a step further with her new album, Stripped, posing on the cover of the album naked from the waist up. So much for the anti-bra and hot pants routine. Aguilera's comment: "I have stripped down to my inner self. I guess I've grown up in a lot of ways." Christina also dubbed herself X-Tina in honor of her newfound sexuality. The song Dirty from the Stripped album had a music video so dirty it was banned in Thailand for promoting immodesty among young girls. The lyrics to Dirty are both incomprehensible and raunchy. A sampling: "Let's get dirty, that's my jam. Ah, heat is up. So ladies, fellas, drop your cups. Body's hot, front to back. Now move your ass. I like that. Tight hip huggers, low for sure. Shake a little something on the floor. I need that to get me off. Sweat until my clothes come off." As Greg Overzat of the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel observed, "Looks like X-Tina should change her name to XXX-Tina." Aguilera's development from clean-cut teen cutie to young, empowered woman also reflects her personal and artistic descent into the world of Madonna-esque subjectivism. Aguilera promotes a world of unbridled hedonism and narcissism. She was willing to ditch traditional morality for the promise of easy money, but there's a price for this decision. Underneath all the talk about doing what she wants to do, Aguilera betrays a deep depression in her words and music. In a 2002 interview with Rolling Stone, Aguilera decided that she no longer wanted to be thought of as pretty, remarking, "I don't like pretty. F the pretty." And adding that she was showing her true colors now. Aguilera also got into self-mutilation through body piercing, explaining, "There's a comfort to me in pain. There's a real sickness in those words. when the world and life mean so little that only pain can prompt feeling, it's time to re-examine your philosophy of amoral freedom and empowerment. Like Aguilera, Spears quickly transitioned from a popular virgin into an even more popular Madonna imitator. Her first